This is a Glass Box Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to This Week in Travel, the show that talks to some of the most interesting and notable travelers in the world, as well as providing useful tips and actionable information. Now, here are your hosts, Gary Arndt, Chris Christensen, and Jen Leo. Oh, and remember, it's This Week in Travel, not Every Week in Travel.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of This Week in Travel. My name is Gary Arndt, and I'm coming to you from a cold and rainy state of Wisconsin, where our motto is eat cheese or die. With us again, as usual, that lovely chuckle in the background is Jen Leo.
Hi, Gary.
To leave the country.
Hi, Gary. How are you doing, Jen? I missed you guys. I'm glad we got the band back together again.
Well, we don't have Chris with us. He's off working or doing a job or something else suckers like that do. You're going to be leaving the country soon, aren't you?
We are. We're headed to Costa Rica on Wednesday. A couple days.
Why did you choose this time to go to Costa Rica?
Because Cora has online learning for a year that we committed to. We committed to independent study. And so that gives us the ability to take off. And so we are, but we're staying within a relatively close time zone. So her socializing with friends and taking classes will be pretty painless.
Fair enough. And do you have internet where you're going?
For the first month, we rented a house for the first month, and it does. It has the fiber optic cable. So then we are going to see where we're going to end up next. But yes, as you know, internet is always a priority.
Indeed. Also from the other state of California, Mr. Spud Hilton, how are you doing, sir?
Doing great. We're here in the state of California. Our motto is breathe, smoke, and die. So that's pretty much what we're doing these days. Spud.
And are you still having like fires and whatnot up there?
Yeah, we have some new fires started a couple days ago up in Sonoma and Napa, and they spread really quickly. And sometimes it sounds like I complain about the smoke, and I just have to remind myself that there are people running for their lives and losing everything they own. So I try to think of, put a little perspective in it, but the smoke from those fires is definitely coming down here and making it hard to breathe.
Well, the good part is eventually, I think you're pretty close to this point, everything will be burned. So there will be no more new fires.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. Or at least it seems that way every so often. You know, we had that orange day a couple of weeks ago where literally there was so much smoke that none of the street lamps, which are all, photosensitive, they turn off during the day. None of them turned off because the sky was so dark all day, and it turned a sort of a San Francisco Giants orange, which is odd. But, everything will burn up eventually. You're right. They'll just run out of fuel, and then we'll start again.
Spud, you had some of the best orange skyline pictures that I saw out there, and yours were so quick to come out. I thought they were actually really, really good.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate that. I got lucky in the sense that I was taking my wife into work the one day she goes into work, and I dropped her off at 9 o'clock in the morning when it should be plenty bright, and it was still nighttime. And so I just drove down to the waterfront with the bridge and Oracle Park and things like that, and got some early shots. And said
that
basically,
pictures were oranger.
Yeah, well, and that I would love to say they, I made them that way, but No, that's exactly what it looked like.
Spud, did you see someone took some drone footage in San Francisco and then put it to the music from Blade Runner?
I think you sent me that, or somebody sent me that. That was both funny and scary at the same time. It was a little bit too close for comfort, because, you know, eventually maybe our sky will look like that all the time. Who knows?
Well, you just have to watch out for the replicants.
Right, exactly. Rutger Hauer. Don't ever cross him, man. I'm telling you.
Our guest this week, she is the woman behind Explore More Family Travel and a travel advisor. Please welcome Jen Campbell Bowles. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you today?
Where are you coming from?
I am in North Carolina. I believe I'm your second guest from North Carolina in a relatively short span of time. So we're really popular right now, I guess.
That'd be a good question, where we've had guests from. I don't think we've ever actually bothered to check that out.
Wait, was the Why Travel blog, yes. The Australians who live over here, which ironically, I'm a dual citizen of Australia. I don't sound like it. I've only lived a year there, but I do have two passports, so I still claim them.
Yeah, if you can get two passports, I would definitely always take advantage of it. I wish I could have a second passport just for the flexibility and safety.
Yeah, and you don't have to worry about visas some places that we Americans do. So it does come in handy.
So let's get into some of the news stories this week. And basically, there's only one real news story this whole year. It's just different variations of the same theme. Hawaii is scheduled to open up to tourists on, October 15th? And they're going to have a COVID testing policy for people that come in. And United Airlines announced that they're going to be offering rapid COVID-19 testing at the San Francisco airport. Spud, why don't you explain a little bit about what they're doing and how this is supposedly going to work?
Well, as I understand it, and this is the story from CNN, is you are taking the test within 72 hours of when you're going to arrive in the islands. And that allows you to sort of bypass the 14-day quarantine that everyone was having to go through in order to get to Hawaii at all. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not complaining about that. I think Hawaii's been brilliant about this policy. But unfortunately, if you live by tourism, you die by tourism. And they've really had to try to find something. And this seems like the best plan so far, possibly one that may spread everywhere else too.
The problem with this is that these tests are not 100% accurate.
That's true.
Not even close. And so you got to remember, this whole global pandemic started with one person, right? There always is a patient zero somewhere that starts these things. And so if a single person gets a false negative and goes to Hawaii, then all of this is going to be kind of moot.
Then you have an outbreak. That's exactly what. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I think it comes down to, I don't know how to put this. It comes down to our wanting so badly to travel and to jumpstart an economy that there's a balance of risk to reward. And I think there's some folks who are saying, well, let's dip the toe in the water. If it seems to work, if we seem to not get any outbreaks, then we're good. But you're right. It only takes one person, who manages to get through the safety net to get an outbreak and change Hawaii's situation with COVID. So I don't know exactly what the answer is. I mean, do you believe that there should be something that moves us forward with this?
You know what, Spud? During this time, I mean, this summer we drove cross country and back, and so stayed in a whole bunch of hotels, a lot of the same brand, but having just also stayed at a hotel a couple nights ago, I would love to see some kind of review system for hotels which rates its COVID carefulness. And I haven't really seen anything like that out there. I love that Hilton partnered with Lysol, but there are so many different brands within Hilton and how hand things vary, place by place, that it's even though you have that brandedness and that partnership, their consistency is, there's still slippage, right? So I would love, even if it was like a blogger or a website or, you know, hotels.com took it on or anything like that, I would love to see some kind of COVID cleanliness review system.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a great idea, and I like that specifically. It's one of those things where the risk versus reward kind of depends on how entitled we are to feel like traveling. And, you know, obviously we're Americans. We feel like we should get whatever we want and be able to travel. That's, you know, where we are. I think it's interesting that on this show, probably back in May, one of us pointed out, it might have been me, I can't remember, my brain's turned to mush by now, but one of us said that at some point, if this continues, instead of experiences being the new luxury, safety will be the new luxury. And I think that's, to some extent, a little bit of what you're talking about. You're talking about reviews, but I think every hotel, especially the higher end chains that have the ability to stretch out spaces and keep people away from each other, that is going to be the new luxury, is, you know, total isolation from other guests, or, you know, being able to absolutely 99.9% guarantee if you come to our resort, you're not going to get this thing.
Or just extra distance, extra cleanliness, extra carefulness. I'm thrilled for Hawaii to find a way to get their tourism back as long as it's safety conscious, right? But sure, of all the accommodation options that you have going in, how do you know which ones? I almost wish they could open with a limited amount, or only to a limited amount of people, right? And just sort of test it in phases, as opposed to just, okay, gates are open October 15th, here's the test, right? Like, is there any way to phase it in?
You know, I think that would be a good idea too. And I'm not seeing anything in this story about any limits on this. You're absolutely right. I'm not seeing anything, and you're probably right. It ought to be one of those things that is phased in through, you know, okay, we'll take 500 people this week and 1,000 people next week, or things like that.
But if people aren't going through San Francisco, just the fact that they have to get this test before they go is in itself a way of weaning people, maybe, because it's not easy to get. Always get your results in 72 hours. And I just think it goes back to the testing. It goes beyond travel. Like, our kids could go to school and, you know, all sorts of things, including getting on an airplane. If there had been more focus on getting these rapid tests developed, everything wouldn't be hanging on this vaccine. If, you know, we had a fast test that was easily accessible for everyone.
No, you're absolutely right.
Speaking of frustrating, rapid tests, I had a friend. We live in Southern California, down North San Diego, and I had a friend tell me that she was going to a party in LA this past weekend, and everybody was like, "How do you go to a party?" And apparently, the host hired a nurse to rapid test everybody upon entry. And I think it was like a 15 or 20 minute turnaround or something like that. I haven't talked to her.
That is the definition right there.
Right. Like, but I immediately wanted to know, oh my gosh, how much does that cost? How much does it cost to host a party with rapid testing?
I would call BS on that, because you're looking for DNA strands, and it's just, you don't just hire a nurse to do that. You need a lab.
What about the people that test workers as they are going into work?
They're mostly testing temperature and stuff. There are things like the NBA with their bubble that have been doing daily tests, but this notion where you just, you know, wipe someone's nose, put it in a machine, and then it gives you a green or a red light. That's not how it works. And I think a lot of this, to be real honest, is just, you know, virus theater. It's things that are happening to make people feel good. You know, a partnership with Hilton and Lysol is nothing but PR and branding. I mean, that's right. All that is. Right. This is a respiratory disease. You know what, you know, when this first started, a lot of people are, you know, wash your hands, and that's fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but that's really not how it spread. It's primarily through the air. So wearing a mask is going to do far more for you than, you know, wiping every surface down all the time. And a lot of that's just done for show.
Well, it's done for confidence. It did make me feel better that the rooms were spaced out time-wise based on when the visitors were in the hotel rooms. And the partnership, when you go through there and you see that things have been wiped down more than once, and then you're told what's been wiped down, it does give you a little bit more confidence.
Oh, sure. That's exactly what it's designed to do. Just like, you know, the TSA and all the stuff at the airport, the fact that they let through, you know, 90% of all the weapons that try to get snuck through in tests is irrelevant. What they do is they then brag about the 10% that they do get on their website every week, right? And that's to make us feel, oh, they're catching all this stuff. And of course, they just ignore everything they're not doing because it's designed to make people feel safe. It's not, you know, if you know how you can't bring water into a secure area on an airport. If water was truly dangerous, right? You should put people in prison who bring water bottles onto airplanes. But we don't. We just throw it away, which means that if it was truly an explosive, you just keep going to the airport over and over and over until you happen to sneak a water bottle through, and then you could do something nefarious. But you know, we don't care about that. So we just pretend that it doesn't happen. And the same is true, I think, with a lot of the virus stuff. I understand why companies are doing it. I'm not even saying they shouldn't do it, but that's what a lot of this is. Because at the end of the day, you can wipe down the room all you want, but it's the ducts in the circulation system in the building, which is how it's going to spread.
On that cheery note.
Yeah, fire. Virus.
Gary, I was looking up virus theater because I thought that would be a fun site to own. But as it turns out, there's actually a theater troupe just called Virus Theater, and they appear to be in New Mexico. So you won't be able to get that. Sorry.
Maybe viral theater.
Ooh, that could be.
I'm looking at Kanapali Resorts right now, where I've stayed at a few different ones of those in the past. And front and center, they have the update for special alerts and notices and for the new COVID stuff. And they have a variety of accommodations that are more spaced out. So you have luxury villas and condominiums, Kanapali Ali'i, Aston Maui Kanapali Villas. So if you want to space out a little bit more, as opposed to staying in the high rise hotel tower, there are those options there. And this is for Maui, Kanapali Maui, if you're headed over there. Really, really lovely experiences. I don't know. Is anybody with the new Hawaiian, with the new Hawaiian shortening of testing and quarantine restrictions, does that up your desire to head over there?
It does mine, because I actually love Kahanapali. And I mean, my boys have been a lot of places, and every time we say, what's your favorite vacation? It's Hawaii. So it's kind of our litmus test. When we're comfortable to go there, since that would be one of the first places to open. We're very cautious, COVID cautious, despite taking this massive road trip. I mean, I think there's something to be said about traveling safe and smart. And so I'm not quite there being ready to be on an airplane, period. If we all had access to these tests before we got on an airplane, I would feel much better. So, yeah, but I mean, every day I'm feeling a little more comfortable with different things. And I definitely think Hawaii is the one, the big draw to like get us out of this, you know, to get us on an airplane eventually. I'm just not sure if I'm ready yet, personally.
Well, Gary, one of the other stories that I think we were might be planning to talk about this week sort of fits into this part of the conversation, which is if what we have now is virus theater or viral theater, what is one of the long-term answers? Because one of the stories we had came from Travel Pulse, and it's, could a health and safety certificate become the norm? And as I understand it, they're mostly talking about, you know, whether or not somebody's had inoculations like you used to have to go to other countries. But when we do actually have a, what's the word? When we actually do have some form of curative vaccination. Vaccination, do you foresee people, and again, I'm sorry, I'm not finishing a sentence here, but they're talking about the importance of making it universal. As in, not just this country has this certificate and this country doesn't at all. They're talking about, would it make sense to make a universal health certificate that you carry along with your passport? Do you foresee something like that?
I don't know. I mean, to a certain extent, I remember when I went to go travel around the world back in 2007, I had to go to a clinic and get a bunch of shots. Actually, it's just like one shot, but, and that included a hepatitis shot, a yellow fever shot, tetanus, a whole bunch of different things. And for yellow fever, there are several countries in Africa that require you to have a yellow fever vaccination. Although, to be honest, it's not really that well enforced. I could possibly see that being some sort of requirement. Either a vaccination, or you could, if you show some sort of antibody or T cell immunity, maybe. I mean, we'll see. I we have a tendency as humans to think that whatever we're going through right now is going to last forever, and I don't think this is permanent. This is something that 5 years from now we're gonna, you know, we probably won't even be talking about. So I don't know if this is going to be permanent. It's something that we may have to deal with over the next 2 years, but I'm not sure. And even then, there are some vaccines that are being, you know, that are in the news right now, but their effectiveness, I don't think, has really been proven yet. You know, there's this one out of Russia, and I think a lot of that, you know, they called it Sputnik, which I think was really, again, more of a PR ploy. It's, oh, look at, Russia's great. So we don't really know how well they work yet. So that there hasn't been huge, let alone the safety of it. So I don't know. I mean, in the short and medium term, yeah, I could see something like that. I don't know how well a lot of this testing is going to do. I guess it's better than nothing, but I don't know. We'll see.
I think, as you mentioned, that we as humans like to think this is going to last forever. I think conversely, we as humans think we can fix anything. And what if it turns out that we don't find a vaccine for this? You know, I don't want to be gloom and doom, but we're kind of too late for that. That ship has sailed. Is there a future that still includes travel, even if there's no vaccine for the next 5 years?
Yeah, I do. What you're seeing in the news now is when people are talking about, oh, there's an outbreak or there's an increase, it's always now in reference to cases, right? There's an increase in cases. And a lot of that might be true, but it's also a function. We now just have testing, or we didn't even have it at all, say, back in March. Or it was very poor and it wasn't well distributed. So we know more. But if you look at deaths, which is, and I understand that there's implications beyond deaths. There are people that are, you know, become very ill. They may not die.
Sure.
But at least deaths are binary. You know, you can tell if someone did or not. And those do not seem to be increasing. The control group for a lot of this seems to be Sweden, which basically kind of did nothing. And if you look at the deaths in Sweden, they had a spike kind of around March, April, and then it went down, and now it's almost nothing. It's, you know, maybe they get one case a day or something like that. And it kind of showed your typical textbook, you know, curve for this sort of stuff. And going back to Hawaii, you know, most of the islands in the Pacific have been spared a lot of this because they're islands. So it was very easy to close their borders. They just, you know, shut things down. Same with New Zealand. The danger is it's as if they were never touched by this, right? It's like they never developed that immunity. So at some point, they're going to open up their borders. And for them, it's going to be like back in March. And so either they're going to have to wait until they can get their population vaccinated, or they run the risk of, you know, an outbreak or having a death spike if and when they open their borders again.
Yeah, and there's a history for that. I mean, the Spanish flu in 1918, you know, it had a massive impact around the world. But when it managed to get to the South Pacific, entire islands lost, you know, 40, 50% of their population because they had been isolated like that. So, yeah, there's something to be said for that.
And not to mention that a lot of these, and I say this having been to pretty much all these countries in the Pacific, they have the highest rates of diabetes in the world, of type 2 diabetes. And type 2 diabetes has been a huge marker for, you know, mortality from COVID. And that could make it even really bad if something like that were to happen.
Sure, sure.
All this COVID talk is great. But Spud, you had another article for us about Princess Diana and her travel tip. What was her pick of the week?
This is all part of the stuff that's coming out, you know, as various disgruntled former workers are writing books and things like that about the royals. As it turns out, and granted, this is in the Express, and for the most part, it's clickbait, because it takes you a while to find out that Princess Diana, in her reign, if you will, actually, do you get to say that a princess had a reign, or is it just the reigning monarch? I don't know. Anyway, apparently there was something that she was always required to take anytime she traveled, and she traveled quite a bit. You know, she went to Belgium, Nepal, Switzerland, Zimbabwe, a lot of different places as part of the royal family's duties to sort of visit either still sort of related, not exactly colonies, or former colonies. And apparently she always traveled with a refrigerator. I'm guessing it was a small refrigerator, but a refrigerator filled with her own blood. And it seems, you know, unusual, but when you think about it, it's like, hey, you get in an accident somewhere around the world and you got to have transfusions.
Right? So I wonder if she was donating blood to herself on a regular basis. Was it just her type of blood?
Blood typing.
Did she have a special blood type that required this?
I don't think so. It doesn't say that here. Apparently the former private secretary, Patrick Jeffson, said, particularly when we were abroad or in the developing world, we would carry a little refrigerator full of spare supplies of Diana's blood. And his comment was that certainly took the glamour out of it, I could imagine. And, you know, who knows? She could have actually, you know, had a rare blood type, but I doubt it. Although, you know, you start to get into royals history, and there's probably some interesting little blood diseases anyway, just because of, how shall we say, a little bit of inbreeding here and there. So I know the Romanovs had that problem with hemophilia. So
I did a search on this. I was wondering to see how common this, you know, carrying blood with you is. So evidently the new presidential limousine has a refrigerator full of blood for the president. And this is the one that they will take with them, you know, if he was to go overseas. So
has he been overseas?
Trump?
North Korea.
So yeah, I don't think it was just Diana, guys. If you Google how to travel with your own blood, right away pops an article. Right away pops an article, the Queen, Prince Charles, and Prince William travel as well.
They know we're going to click on Princess Diana versus the rest.
Exactly,
of them.
Jen.
Exactly. I just like that your mind works, that you would actually Google how to travel with your own blood. I love that.
Trump supposedly says he has the best blood. It's great, great blood.
No one has blood. Better blood than him.
No one has better blood.
It has huge platelets, huge. Yeah. No, I thought that was an odd story, but as it turns out, apparently a lot of people travel with their own blood. I do travel with my own blood, but I try to keep it inside my body instead of in a small refrigerator. So there is that.
Good plan.
One other news story. The CDC has announced their Thanksgiving travel guidelines, which basically consist of don't travel. And I don't know if you've noticed, but a lot of companies are canceling all of their Black Friday stuff this year.
What do you mean?
Like Walmart is not going to do it. Like they're just not doing specials, or they're not opening their store at all because
they
don't
all be online.
Right, because of the crowds.
Which is different. And just out of curiosity, I'm going to ask you all this. So let's say we're recording this week in travel 2 years from now, 3 years from now. What from this period of time is going to stick with us? The changes that we made that, you know, maybe we'll go back to some extent, but a lot is it, you know, and it could be not even just travel stuff. Like, for example, Cora is doing online schooling. Do you think she'll maybe continue to do more of this? Could be testing to get on a flight, you know. We stopped doing Black Friday stuff. What from this period of time do you think is going to stick with us even when we go back to normal?
I'm loving online grocery shopping. So shopping for my groceries online and just driving over to Ralph's, popping the trunk and letting somebody put it in has saved me so much time. And I know other people are getting delivery for their food, but I really like the Ralph's shopping. I'm not going to want to quit that once we go back.
You know, what's funny, Jen, is I go shopping probably more often than I should. Maybe I should be one of these, Instacart shoppers, but it's my only diversion.
That's your only slice of normal, right?
Yeah, exactly. I can't go to the bar. We go to restaurants now a little bit and sit outside and do the whole thing. But other than that, we really don't have that many diversions. And the idea of going to the store where I can, I keep space and I'm wearing a mask, but I can wander around there for an hour and only buy a couple of things just because it's like, it's somewhere other than my apartment. So I totally get that.
I'm with you. I used to do online, pop the trunk and they put it in. And now I'm like, no, that's my little getaway.
Yeah.
Like, I look forward to it now.
I had a friend, she read it from an article and I don't remember where the source was, but it really stuck with me. She said that everybody sort of has this basket of risk, right? And how you put your risk, what types of risk you put in your basket differs from person to person. So One family might be, completely locked down and not going to restaurants, but they're going to Costco 2-3 times a week. Another family might not be doing restaurants at all, but they're sending their kids to brick and mortar school. And so you're seeing this difference. We are not going to school, but we are doing, outdoor patio dining and, traveling as safely as we can. So I think every person has their risk basket just slightly different from the next person.
It really is fascinating to me. Like in each group of friends or family that I have, everybody's got a different level. And while I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're doing that. And then they're looking at me like, oh, well, I can't believe you just drove across the country,
Right.
So, it really is fascinating to me. That's one of the biggest eye-opening things to me in all of this.
I think to answer Gary's question, the things that I probably may have changed possibly forever, or, you know, we're looking back 5 years from now, is that I probably will still be drinking box wine instead of, you know, getting something expensive. So.
Oh, Spud, that's, I have only known you to drink cocktails.
Well, yeah, I drink a lot of Prosecco, but, you know, you go to try to buy a week's worth of booze three times a week, and it's really heavy. So, right. You know, boxes are a little more, no, I'm just kidding.
Well, this is also in the CDC article, or in the article that we're talking about for Thanksgiving. They are sort of cautioning against you using alcohol or drugs because it can cloud judgment and increase risky behaviors.
Well, and that's only if you're actually out. You know, my plan for Thanksgiving is basically to, you know, curl up in a ball in the corner with a bottle of vodka, and that way I won't have any risky behavior whatsoever. So I think they're overstepping by saying don't use alcohol or drugs.
I would also think that if you're going to put out a safety advisory for Thanksgiving, you'd put something in about frying a turkey. Because every year someone burns their house down doing that. Every yeah. single year.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there are definitely numbers about that. And actually, for me, it'd be, you know, a bottle of alcohol and that wonderful canned jelly cranberry stuff that, you know, I could live off that. That's just awesome stuff. And the CDC says there's no problem with that. So it must
and
be okay.
What about the Thanksgiving Day parade in New York? Is that canceled this year?
I think it has to be.
Right.
I think by almost the way, every. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say largest producer of cranberries in the country, Wisconsin.
There you go. There you go. It's not all about cheese.
More than just cheese. Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually now their new state motto, more than just cheese.
Yeah, it's also beer. I mean,
yeah,
I must say the one thing I've enjoyed of living here again is fresh cheese curds, which have just this is the only place you can find them is Wisconsin. And the stores know to put out a bunch every morning. So they're at room temperature when you buy them, not in the refrigerator. And you can get honest to goodness real cheese curds, not hunks of cheese. And I think most people haven't even had honest to goodness cheese curds because you have to get them squeaky.
Yeah, squeaky cheese.
You have to squeak when they're in the mouth.
I've had them.
Yes.
In Wisconsin.
I had fried cheese curds in Wisconsin once, and that was literally one of the best things that I've ever tasted. How do you prepare them, Gary? Do you like yours unfried?
Yeah, fresh cheese curds. You just get straight cheese curds. Yeah, but you have to eat them at room temperature. I mean, you can get them refrigerated, but you got to let them warm up. When they're room temperature, that's when they're at their best. The Society of American Travel Writers was supposed to have their convention in Milwaukee this year. That obviously got canceled. So it's going to be there next year. So I would recommend going and experiencing. I will actually bring you DuPont cheese curds. Which is like the best cheese company that I found in the state. And the ones I always get.
Tell us that date again.
It's October something, 2021.
Yeah. I mean, there is a virtual convention this year, but it's tough to get fresh cheese curds through the internet. So it's probably not going to happen that this year.
Why don't we move on to our guest then? East Coast Jen is how I will refer to. Why don't you give us your backstory and how you got involved with travel and what it is that you do?
Well, I think travel was always just an important part of my life, and that my grandmother is Australian. And so my mom and then my grandfather was from Georgia. Actually, I'm from Georgia, Savannah, Georgia, before North Carolina. And so they were always back and forth and back and forth deciding where to live until my mom was a teenager. But even then, like in my childhood memories, I remember going to the airport often, seeing my grandma and grandpa off because they were gone for 3 to 6 months to go back for her to see her family. And so just this idea of travel and living somewhere else. And my parents met on board ship. My dad was actually moving to Australia. They met, so he ended up coming back when she came back because she was just visiting. So there's just a sense of wanderlust and, you know, adventure in my blood. But that being said, my mom, I think, would have preferred me just to go to Australia and Europe and that sort of thing. And I actually moved to Australia to just live and understand where, you know, part of my heritage. When I was, I think I was 23 or 24 or something like that, I'd started a job out of college and I was like, no, there's something more before I get settled down. So when I was over there, I met all these backpackers from Britain, basically. And they were like, no, you don't just come and live in Australia. You backpack in Australia. You had to go up the coast and you have to go through the Northern Territory and all of this. I'm like, okay, sign me up. So I did that and just really fueled the wanderlust. And at that point, I was just hooked. And so I think it's really interesting, you know, with the event of internet and whatnot, like just understanding that there's more people like me. And I just feel like when I first started traveling like that, people were like, what are you doing? It felt odd as an American. Like I didn't meet that many Americans in Australia or anything like that. And so it's refreshing now that there are these communities of like-minded people who love to explore. But that being said, I started working real jobs, stopped my traveling, and I really get jealous when I listened to you guys and some of your guests and knowing that I could have been monetizing this long, long ago, doing this full time. But, you know, now that it's so saturated, so it makes it it's a lot harder. And I was like, I was doing a lot of this anyway. And, but I had a desk job, but I had a pretty flexible vacation. And so I just traveled every minute I could when I wasn't at work. And eventually I found a husband who also loves to travel. And I actually lost a job and he was getting out of the military right before we got married. So we took a 6-week honeymoon. I was hoping to take a 3-month, but he's not quite as ambitious as me. He always reins me in a little bit. And, you know, we just always made travel a priority. And so when I had my twins, I was like, I decided to stay home with them. And when it was time for them to go to kindergarten, I wanted to have a career in travel. And I wasn't sure what that looked like. I met with a lot of people. I studied blogging. I studied everything I could get my hands on, but ultimately decided to start a travel business where I would sell travel, but with just a heavy emphasis on the content. I wanted to show people that it is not as hard as some people make it, that you can work, you know, go to regular school when there is regular school and just fit it in all the in-between moments. And so that's kind of, I love the idea of traveling full time, but I don't think it would work for us just based on circumstances. So my goal is to show people you can, you know, have a desk job and a, you know, a home base, but that doesn't mean you can't go as often as possible. And that's kind of how led us to trying to make the most of these stay at home, you know, these COVID times.
Jen, tell us a little bit more about what you recently did with your cross-country schoolcation. I think that's pretty fascinating, especially since we're right about to do that ourselves.
I know. I'm very excited for you guys. And I mean, you get to go to Costa Rica. I mean, that's, you know, that's amazing. I love Costa Rica. I wish we could do something bigger like that. But I kept thinking about doing it all summer long. But at first, when everything started opening up, I was still too nervous. I didn't know what outside this little bubble was that we'd been living in for the previous, you know, 2 to 3 months, which is ironic because that's one of the things I say is like, I want to encourage families to get outside of their bubble and travel more and see the world and understand other people and cultures. But here I was, you know, in a bubble, really afraid to break out of it for a while. And so we first started dipping our toe in the water in June. We went out to the beaches of North Carolina and the Outer Banks, and you know, that went well. And then
how old are the kids? Excuse me. How old?
Oh, sure. I'm 7-year-old twin boys. Got lots it. Of energy. Yeah. So, yeah. And then we really love just to kind of sit and relax for our vacations. So, with like a dose of other things in there, but you know, plenty of time at like a beach or a pool. And so we wanted to spend a week of vacation in Florida. So we booked that early on, and then it became a hot spot. So I was like, oh no, what are we going to do? So I did a lot of research and I saw that, you know, where we were going wasn't a hot spot and that they had a lot of, you know, processes in place and mask mandate were in the town where we were going. And so once we went there and I saw that people were, you know, doing the right thing. A lot of the stories made it sound like people weren't doing the right thing, but everything we saw for the most part was, you know, things, how we were living our life here. You know, we would sit outside to eat and we'd wear a mask when we were, you know, briefly inside of somewhere or if an area was crowded. So I was like, you know, we could have gone out west. I think we could have done it, but school may or may not have been starting in August. And so once our kids' school decided, like, we're going to hold off a little bit and we're going to start school later, you know, hybrid 2 days a week. We could opt out as well, but they're actually in a loop year, which means they have the same teacher and classmates. And it was really hard to think about them not going back to those same people. So we opted for hybrid. But when it got the late start, when they're like, it's not going to start till at least after Labor Day, I was like, we have to go now. Like, we've been toying with this idea. This is our opportunity. I can teach them, you know, and work a little, do my, you know, content creation. My husband can work his full-time job. You know, we had to worry about the time zone and everything. But so we decided on a Monday to leave on a Saturday. And so we put it together and we just started driving. And it was just such a great decision. We just had such an amazing time getting out. And I think the big thing for us is that we were seeing something we probably would not see if it wasn't for COVID, because we love international travel. We love getting on an airplane and we love going far. And like our last trip before this one was Thailand. So, you know, just the thought that we probably would not take the vacation time to do this in normal times, let's take advantage of now and what we can do now and do it in a smart and safe way.
Did the kids actually have to take classes while you were on the road?
Yes.
Even over the summer?
No. So our school starts in mid-August. So we left, you know, the first or the second Saturday in August. So the first week they didn't have school, but the last 3 weeks they did. And so, you know, they weren't set up to have to be in front of a computer from morning to night. It was a lot of, you know, watch this, do this, you know, those sort of things. I know some schools around here are doing like Zoom with the teacher all day long. So it wasn't like that. I think that made it easier as well. But yeah, so we were able to work in all their lessons and, you know, we were kind of waking up early because of the time difference. So we were done around lunch every day. And then I could take the kids to do something. And then my husband would get off a couple hours later. So in the afternoons we would, you know, like in Wyoming, we went horseback riding one day. We went to a rodeo one night. We went to Grand Teton National Park one day after
beautiful,
we got off work.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So it was just like, we were exhausted, but we were doing way more than what we do at home. But we were, after being at home for so long, it was just so nice to be out doing things outdoors and things that we would have never done otherwise. And then on the weekends, we would cover a lot of ground basically. So we would see a lot on the weekends and move from one place to another. And so we did 7 national parks in a month. And you know, that's kind of the perfect thing to do right now in a lot of ways, because you're outdoors. And I know a lot of people are doing it in a lot of different ways. Some people are RVing it. Some people are, you know, staying in hotels. And, you know, we kind of did a mix of, like, we would stay in rentals during the week so we had more room for the school and the working. And then on the weekends when we were covering lots of ground, we'd stay, you know, closer to the sites and that sort of thing in hotels and resorts. And it really worked out well.
Hey, Jen.
Yep.
This is a question for both Jens, actually. It's for both Jens. Gary was just talking about what are some of the things that are going to, for some people, change permanently, or at least for, you know, the mid to long term. Do you foresee more people opting out of the conventional orthodox approach to education and realize that there's something to be said for experiential learning instead of necessarily just sitting in front of, you know, sitting in a class and listening to somebody tell you something? I know this has been out a long time. There's a lot of bloggers, family bloggers, who all said, oh, we decided to take our kids out of school and roam the world and it was better for them. And that's fine. But there's a whole lot more people considering and doing that now. Do you foresee that either increasing or at least, at the very least, enduring?
Yes, I think it will increase, but the difference that I'm seeing, as you know, so our kids in our area just sort of got into school about a month ago, and the community that I was in for elementary school is now split. So half the kids are still doing brick and mortar school, even though that's distance. And then half the kids are doing the independent study like we are. Now, the difference, a lot of these choices have to make are the working conditions of the parents. So a lot of the two-parent working, office-type working families sort of have been sticking with the brick and mortar because they're expecting to have to go back to work, right? And so I think what we're seeing is a slow change with all the people that are working from home. Some of them are thinking, oh, well, if I'm working home and being this productive now, I think I can find ways to continue that if that suits their lifestyle. And so I think those people will sort of gravitate more towards, oh, well, if I can work from home, maybe I can digital nomad, right? So a lot of the tech companies are not going back to offices. So, you know, there's a guy on our street that, you know, works for a tech company, an app company in Silicon Valley, but he works from home down here, and they're considering going to Jackson Hole, Wyoming for a month, where their relative rented a house. And then, you know, we're taking off to Costa Rica. But like you said, Spud, the people that are have been more digitally nomad, blogger minded in their previous life, they're up for this challenge, right? Or they're up for this change. But the people that are not from this world, I think it's going to be a slow adaptation to it, because I was surprised, just as I was telling, you know, my school mom friends, okay, we're taking off, envy is the wrong word, but so many of them were so interested in living vicariously, and they were making such a big deal about our departure. Oh my gosh, we have to see you one more time. And the comments that we got about how sort of magnificent this was such a shock to me, because, you know, as you've all known and our listeners have known throughout Cora's life of the past almost 12 years, you know, we've been in other places. You know, we expatted in London, and we've traveled here and we've traveled there, and it wasn't really so much of a surprise to me that we would be leaving, but the reactions to us going and doing this now were drastically different. And I think that people, because they've been shut in, I think the desire to be somewhere else is greater. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Was the hardest part about expatting in London learning the language? No, I'm just kidding about that.
Yeah, hey, not East Coast. I guess not real expatting, but we were like just being somewhere else and being different was it's not foreign to us.
Sure, sure. Hey, East Coast Jen, what's your answer to that earlier question?
Well, I do. Let me just before I forget this thought of the last thing West Coast Jen just said was. There did seem to be a lot more interest in this trip for us than our previous trips. And I just thought people were more interested in national parks, maybe than our last trip to Thailand or our trip to Greece before that. But maybe it is this just we haven't been able to go anywhere. And so people are like more fascinated with the idea of getting out of the current situation, you know. I do think that there might be more of this. I think there's some, especially for families who aren't maybe happy with their school system, and they're like, okay, well, we can do this. We did it. Or, you know, some of them have opted out of the virtual plans by their school system and are doing a traditional homeschool for the year. And so maybe they'll find out that they like that it works for them. We're not those people though. my husband had, you know, I think he'll have to go back to the office. He works for a big bank. So I think when it's safe to do so, I don't think he'll be one of the ones where they're like, okay, let's just continue to work like this. We have on a smaller scale been able to do that some, just being able to, you know, even in better times, take a day or two for him to work from afar so that we could have extra time somewhere. But it wasn't, you know, the norm. It was just an exception sometimes. Also, like, we absolutely adore our kids' school, and I've always said, I mean, I'm like, how do people homeschool? How do people homeschool? I don't know. My kids just don't listen to me. They listen to other people so much better. And, you know, I had to work through that during this time, but it's nothing that I relish and want to, you know, keep on doing. I did when we first got the notice about, you know, we could choose between a virtual year or a hybrid. I said to my husband, I'm like, let's do the full year and let's just go. And he's like, I don't know when I'll be called back in. I'm like, I can't see you being called back in before there's a vaccine or a rapid test. And, but you know, like, it's a marriage, it's a compromise. And so we have to find a happy place. But for me, I would have done it for 1 year in the special circumstance, but it's not something that I would want to continue to do. But I think there are going to be families who do.
Sure. Let me ask you this. Which was probably more valuable to your twins as an educational experience, going and seeing all the national parks or staying in a traditional school setting and making macaroni art on paper?
I'm going to go with national parks.
That's but the right answer.
It really is amazing to me what some of these activities are really getting to when you get down to it. Like some of the things the teachers come up with to teach them, and I would have never thought of that. And I'm more like, hey, let's do this math problem, you know, not like, I can't give an example. But now that I see what they do, you know, I'm more impressed with how they learn and how education, you know, how teachers do what they do. I mean, I've always had the respect for them managing so many little kids at a time, but now just that there's just so much more to it than, you know, I would see at face value, like actually seeing the kids do it. I now see kind of how it helps them learn. But it's still so not easy for me to get my kids to understand how to do something when they're frustrated, and just knowing that a teacher could do it, I just feel like, you know, that and the fact that they had this loop year where they were going to go back to their same teachers, I struggled with it because, you know, safety wise, I think it would be safer for them not to go in. But anyway,
I think a lot of it has to do with the families, Spud. So many families are different and have different approaches. But if you want your kids to have that experience that is so far different from what they're going to get in a public school, you have to make the effort. And it's not just getting to the new destination. It's actually from there talking to them, right? Talking to them and connecting the dots between what they're seeing and, you know, a nod to Chris, who's not here with us today, the history of where you are and what you're seeing and what does it mean. And as they get older, challenging them to look up and research what it is they're seeing and what is exciting them in the place. Because when you have the younger kids, you can do a lot of telling, right? But when you get into the older kids, the challenge is getting them to engage and discovering what they want to engage with. And so I think that's tricky for everybody, but the more you get involved, the deeper the learning experience.
And our kids had journals while we were gone. And so like at each national park, you know, we'd get them a sticker for the outside of it. And they wrote every day we were gone, what we did that day. And, you know, they give you all these, like the map and the brochure at each park. And so they took those and they cut out and they made art and they did all of that. And so, I mean, absolutely, that was way more than they'd get out of some things. But, you know, I like the balance because I just also think that the teachers do much better with them than I do. And so, but that's why in normal times we take them, you know, I will take my kids out of school to take them, you know, on a vacation or anything. Like I think that it's important to find a balance between those two things. And so, you know, teach them through travel and for us also through traditional means.
I wonder if that balance is one of those things that will change. In other words, you know, we look at America and we get less vacation time than a lot of, you know, a lot of other industrialized countries. Mm-hmm. We put a priority on work. And in that same sense, we put a priority on school and being in school. And I wonder if something that will come out of this, because sort of Gary opened the door by saying what things will change permanently. Maybe it's just that balance that might start to change some, which is, you know, will we decide that maybe we spend only half the year in school and the other half the year traveling, or at least that's an option for those who have the option of traveling, because obviously not everybody does.
And that's something that about year-round school. I mean, I love the idea of that, and I wish that was more prevalent in places, because that allows you to travel more often, I feel like. Instead of this big, you know, chunk of time in the middle of the summer, if you space it out through the year, that just opens up, you know, and just to be able to travel in the off-season and that sort of thing when it's more affordable, because, you know, traveling in the summer is expensive. And so just being able to space it out and do it more often, I love the idea of that.
Sure. And as far as the history goes, all you really have to do is require your kids to daily listen to the Everything Everywhere Daily podcast.
Nice plug.
Because
I don't think Gary answered that question, his own question. Gary, do you want to jump back in and answer what you think is actually going to stay?
Video conferencing. That has, we've had video conferencing available for years, but it was never really, I think, culturally acceptable or something that you would do. And so, especially for business travel will never go back to what it was, because the fact is a Zoom call or something like that is so much cheaper and uses so much less time, yet it's 90% of what you can get out of a meeting in face-to-face, that it's just going to be adopted by more and more companies. That and working from home. You know, there's a lot of companies, I think it was, I forget who it was. It was a big company in San Francisco. Basically, they were going to open up this brand new office and they canceled it. And it's like, yeah, we're just going to have people keep working from home. Skift in New York, they canceled the lease on their office, and now they don't have an office at all. And a lot of places are realizing that this is perfectly fine, that their productivity didn't go down, and it's just a whole bunch of overhead. And the other thing I think that'll really be affected more than, say, primary or secondary education is going to be at the college and university level. Because if you can sit and take a class online, why do you pay $60,000 for that? And but I'm serious, because I mean, and universities are going to have a massive reckoning in the next few years, because it's simply not sustainable what they're doing. And if you can go and get a free, and I mean this in a quite literal sense, course from MIT and learn the same thing, why are you paying so much? And like Elon Musk and Google have recently come out saying, we don't care if you have a college degree. We just care that you are capable, and you know, maybe they'll have a test to determine that, but that's it. That you know, that's all they really care about. And I think that you're going to see that more and more, that you know, we've been pitching getting a college education for so long, and the price of it has gone up so high that if you're saddled with $250,000 in debt when you graduate, or God forbid, these people who decide to go to grad programs in like English literature or philosophy, who then get even more debt and zero job prospects, it's just not tenable. So I think that is. But with that, I think we should probably move on to our picks of the week and move on from there. And I'll actually go first this week. And I know we've talked about it several times over the course of the podcast, but I'll mention it again. And that is Duolingo. I've actually started learning Latin on Duolingo. Which is the difficult thing about learning Latin, of course, is that it's not like you can go into an immersion program. they just don't exist. But I took Latin in high school. I took a semester of it. A little bit of it stuck. And the Duolingo approach is very different than trying to learn classical Latin, where you got to learn all the declensions and everything. And if you've ever seen like The Life of Brian, where they fixes when he's doing graffiti and they go and fix his Latin. It's not like that at all. And it's core of a more of an understanding towards the different declensions and everything. And I don't think it'll make you fluent in it, but it's been very interesting trying it out. It's super simple. And I could easily see for learning the basics for a language before you were to go somewhere, like a French, Spanish, Italian, stuff like that, it would be real helpful. So I don't know what I'm going to do to once I get beyond this for Latin. I think there are some things online. Like, believe it or not, there's actually a version of Wikipedia in Latin. But that's probably a bit beyond me. But yeah, Duolingo.
Nice, nice.
West Coast, Latin, Jen, what do you got for us? Oh, go ahead, Spud.
No, I was just saying Latin. Only you, Gary. Only you.
Yeah, it's not good for travel unless you're going back in history and you want to actually read some of the things like Marcus Aurelius or Caesar's commentaries in the original Latin. West Coast, Jen, what do you got for us?
Okay, so Cora is doing this totally cool after-school program, and it is virtual, and it can be done, I think, from anywhere, and it is called CampKidsForPeace.org, and it is sort of this subset after-school program stemming from Kids for Peace, which is a global initiative to spread the peace pledge and building community and all sorts of good change the world vibes for kids. And so she took the camp over summer and it was fantastic. So we decided to do it again. It is virtual and it is weekly, but they separate them by ages. So they've got juniors grades 2 through 3, middles grades 4 through 5, and seniors grades 6 through 8. And anyways, it does a lot for community building and teaching kids about service and all sorts of crafting and activities to keep them engaged. And we just really like it. So I'm going to suggest that, CampKidsForPeace.org. If you can't get out and explore right now, this is a really good way to connect kids to the rest of the world by this type of community building and thinking.
Excellent. And West Coast Spud, what do you got for us?
Well, it isn't exactly new, but I've always kind of liked Rick Steves' book, Travel as a Political Act. And I think right now, even though you can't actually do the travel, a lot of the book is explaining the deeper reason that you should travel, not just, oh, I want to go and see, you know, Big Ben in London, but actually traveling to make connections around the world. Well, you don't actually have to go do those things that he talks about in the book to learn why they're important. And I think the book itself, especially as people are taking their kids on the road or their teenagers or whoever, having a better understanding, especially with kids who might not have traveled, that there is something deeper than just being necessarily a sightseer, is a good thing. And Rick Steves does a pretty good job of explaining that. So that's probably my pick.
I've always, when I started travel, I always felt it was very much not a political act. Simply because if you politicize everything, and then this goes into boycotting different countries and stuff like that, just because if you do that, then, if you do go somewhere, then you're basically saying, yeah, I got no problem with this place, even though they might have problems.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. There was a pretty good article written a few years back by Michael Luongo, well-known travel advocate and writer. And he did it for the Chronicle for my section on LGBTQ travel. And he was basically saying even these countries where they don't have the best policies, and in his specific case, LGBTQ policies, you still need to go, if only to, it's not about supporting the government and their policies. It's about supporting that LGBTQ community that lives there, about showing them that there are more people like them in the world, and about, what's the best way to put it, about patronizing those businesses. It's reaching out to people where you're not just reaching out to the politics of a country, you're reaching out to the people who actually live there. And I thought that was a pretty good way to approach it. I think Steve's talks a little about that too.
And finally, East Coast Jen, do you have anything for us this week?
Well, sure. I guess my tip would be, you don't have to go big to do a schoolcation. There's something to be said just for getting a break. I mean, my trip certainly wasn't a break. It was more of a, an exploration. And so it doesn't have to be that. It can be smaller. There are actually packages with a lot of resort brands right now that allow you the space for working or schooling while traveling. I mean, and that kind of sounds weird, why would you pay? Well, because someone could oversee your kid in a social distance setting while you get a little break if you've been with them nonstop for 6 months. I know Club Med has a property in Florida, and then there's Four Seasons in Florida. They're doing it as well. There's some in Mexico. I have a list that I've been keeping for those interested.
Jen, I also meant to ask you, tell us a little bit about your travel advisor business as it relates to these schoolcation packages.
Well, it's just, booking like a normal trip that I would book for someone. Everything I do is custom. So it's just finding the good fit of a property or a tour company or whatever it is. And it would be the same here. It's, some people, I don't necessarily want my kids, someone else to oversee my kids' learning, but not everyone feels that way, the online stuff. And so, every situation is different, and just finding the best fit for what's available right now. And for some people it's, for some luxury clients, that means staying at a villa and just having, work from paradise or school from paradise, whereas some people are looking for an actual break and for someone else to take over for a little while. Some people aren't comfortable flying yet, and if they live in the Southeast, well, these packages in Florida might work. So it really just depends on the client.
All right. Let's start to wrap things up then. Jen, where can people find you online? West Coast Jen.
West Coast Jen. I think Cora and I are going to continue our coffee connections in Costa Rica. So you can find me on YouTube. And so we'll put a link to that where we're going to be just under my YouTube channel. And then also on Twitter at Jen Leo, we'll also be posting some pictures and links there too.
Excellent. East Coast Jen, where can people find you online?
My website is exploremorefamilytravel.com. And that is basically my handle for Pinterest and Instagram and Facebook. And that is exploremorefamilytravel. And also I have a YouTube channel, but I don't have it to my handle. So you just have to look up Explore Family Travel and it shows up. I am working on that. But yeah, so all those strange characters at the end of my link for my, I don't have a handle set up yet. But yeah, that's where you can find me. Lots of places.
Excellent. Spud, when is the Inappropriate Traveler podcast going to return?
We have some guests lined up for this week, provided the smoke doesn't get too bad, because frankly, we were going to be doing the actual session in our backyard, which is about the size of a walk-in freezer. And but if we don't get that, I've decided to finally crack down and actually start doing the podcast remotely, because I think it can be done well remotely. It's just not nearly as fun. I like being in the same room and drinking with people, and that's when good stuff usually happens. But I've broken down. We're going to start doing them remotely, which means we should have an entire season two. Until then, you can still find season one at Inappropriate Traveler on iTunes and Spotify. InappropriateTraveler.com has some interesting coding problems, but I'm also at SpudHilton.com. And pretty much every social media is Spud Hilton.
Hey, Spud, didn't tell us about the award that your podcast got. I think I saw that recently. You were awarded something.
Yeah, it was late last year. The wonderful Telegraph of London decided to put into both print and online. I was surprised that the Inappropriate Traveler is one of the top 10 travel podcasts to listen to in 2020. This is before they knew that 2020 was going to be a major dumpster fire. So I'm not sure if us being the poster child for 2020 is to our benefit. But yes, the Telegraph of London decided to bestow that on us because they said that we were doing things that nobody else was doing, which was having a lot of fun and being a little irreverent.
Excellent.
Congratulations on that. That's cool.
Thank you.
And as usual, you can find me every single day over at Everything Everywhere Daily. My latest episode was about Isambard Kingdom Brunel, the great British engineer of the 19th century. And until next time, remember to go outside and please remember to wear a mask.